Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. How you doing there, Mr. Hampton?
Good afternoon, Brother Derek.
How are you?
Happy holidays to you and the family, man.
Hey, happy holidays. I wanted to tell you and the fans out there, our listeners, very happy holidays. I hope everything's going well for everyone and their families out there.
Yes, sir.
You doing fine? So how are you doing? Good?
I'm good, man. I'm excited about the weekend and looking forward to, having the kids in. My son is traveling back. They played out in Seattle last night, and he's on his way back. So he'll be here in a couple of days. Looking forward to that, man.
Oh, that's good to hear. Well,
yep,
and you welcome everybody,
here,
sir. Your daughter?
No, I was just going to say my daughter will be here Christmas. So, hey, it's going to be nice.
Well, it should be a great holiday. I'm glad to hear that. That's excellent. Well, sir, I guess we're going to kick it off today. I'm kind of excited today. I know you are as well. We have a list. We have a guest today. I want to tell the listeners, this gentleman has been involved in the NBA for over 42 years. He's been a general manager, a scout. He's been a coach. He's been involved in player personnel. He's pretty much done it all, and I'm honored to have him on the show today. I want everyone to say hello, and I want to say hello as well to Mr. Pete Babcock. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine, Derek. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Mr. Babcock, I'm on here with my partner today, Mr. Ricky Hampton. So also, how you doing? Say, Ricky, say hello, please.
Hey, Pete, how you
Ricky.
Doing, man?
I'm doing fine, Ricky. How are you?
Happy holidays to you.
Thank you. You too.
Well, Mr. Babcock, I'm glad to hear. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, first of all. I've been keeping up with you for years. A lot of the basketball players, the fans might not be very familiar with you, but I'm very familiar with you. I think you've had an excellent career, and it's really a big, big honor to have you on the show, and I thank you for even taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. Anytime.
Well, I have to tell the fans, because I'm a big NBA guy. A lot of the fans know I've been following the game for a long time. My brother playing so long. You're very familiar with George. Could you tell people how your career started, how it evolved until you becoming involved in the NBA for so many years?
Well, very different than your brother, because I was not a player of any sort whatsoever, other than playing in junior college. After high school, but I started as a high school coach in Phoenix, Arizona, and I always was infatuated with the NBA. I always wanted to find a way to work in the NBA, but I had no idea how to get there. I didn't know anybody I could call and ask for a job. I didn't have any contacts. So I took a year while I was coaching in high school, and I just videotaped every NBA game I could possibly videotape. And in those days, there weren't that many of them on TV, but I would break down the tapes, study them. I'd build files on each team. So I had, they had the San Antonio Spurs file. I had the Denver Nuggets file. I had the Boston Celtics file and on and on. And I would chart their plays and take notes on their team and strengths and weaknesses of the players. It really is a self-education project for myself to learn really the ins and outs of how NBA coaches organized their teams and ran their teams. And then at the end of the year, I decided I'd just take a chance and I would send a copy of each report that I wrote to that specific team, figuring they would know better than anybody else if my report was any good. So, and in those days we didn't have internet, we didn't have email. So I wrote a letter to each team. And I just said, you don't know me. I'm a high school basketball coach. I live in Phoenix, Arizona. And here's a copy of a report I wrote on your team this year. If you think it's any good, I want to volunteer to scout for your team for free. When teams come through Phoenix to play the Suns, I'll go down, scout their opponents for you, and mail the report for you, and it won't cost you a penny. Well, a few teams wrote back and said, thanks, but no thanks. A few teams wrote back, most teams, I'm assuming, probably threw my stuff away because they didn't have a clue who I was. But one team, the old New Orleans Jazz, they wrote back, and Elgin Baylor was the head coach at the time. Bill Burtka was the general manager at the time. And they contacted me and said that they didn't have much of a budget for scouting, so I wanted to scout for free. Go ahead. So I did. And I scouted 2 years for the Jazz for free and got a chance to get experience and exposure, made my mistakes, got better at it. You know, Bill Burtka was very instrumental in helping me, you know, correct my mistakes and write better reports. And at the end of 2 years, I got hired by the Lakers as a part-time scout. When Jack McCloskey was the assistant coach there and Jerry West was the head coach. Then went with the Bucks when Don Nelson was the head coach as a regional scout, and then signed with the San Diego Clippers as an assistant coach with Paul Silas, and then later became the GM there, and then the GM in Denver and the GM in Atlanta on and on. So that's kind of how it progressed. So it was just trying to find a way to get experience and exposure.
Wow.
Wow.
That's a lot of travel. You go ahead and read it. Man.
I mean, that is totally awesome, man. That is just amazing. And that's old school. No video, no email, no digital stuff. I mean, you just got down in the dirt and got it done.
Old school.
I'm saying this with all due respect and admiration, but you sounded like you may have been a basketball nerd of some kind, Pete.
Well, yeah, I mean, I love the game. You know, as I said, I was always an overachieving player. I was never a great player, but I loved it. I wanted to find a way to see if I could make a living with the game. And, you know, and I love coaching high school basketball. I was perfectly happy doing it, but I was always, like I said, infatuated with the NBA. I thought, well, this is the best basketball there is. If I could find a way to work at this level, I would, you know, I would do it. And so I just tried to creatively figure out how to get my foot in the door. And it literally was old school because, you know, we're talking about, had, you know, hand mailing stuff to teams, and you know they would have to mail things back to me, and you know, there was no internet, there was no way of communicating electronically.
That is fabulous, man. But you know, Derek, our good friend Coach Ray Scott, I'm sure you know him, Pete, former coach of the Pistons,
yes.
A friend of the show. He talked about when he coached that there was no assistant.
Right.
I mean, you were the coach, and you were the coach.
Yeah. When I started coaching with Paul Silas in San Diego, that was 1980. So that was after Ray had already coached, and we had two assistants on our staff, myself and Bill Westfall, Paul Westfall's older brother, but we did everything. We had nobody else on the staff. Like, my responsibilities were, I was on the bench for our games, but I was in charge of being the advanced scout, preparing our team for our opponents. I did all the college scouting. Nobody else in the organization saw a college game, period, during the course of the season. I did player development, worked on that all summer long with players. We just didn't have – we were the whole basketball staff. Today you've got, you know, I don't know how many people – staffing teams today that do all these things. So the good part of that was it gave me great experience. You know, I got an opportunity to learn how to do each one of those jobs. And then so years later, when I became a general manager and I'm hiring people to do those jobs, I had a good feel in my mind of what I was looking for and what skill sets I was looking for that somebody would need to have.
Yeah. Mr. Babcock, when you came into this business, I know you made up your mind you wanted to get involved in the NBA. You didn't know how it would turn out from the beginning. But you had to have a certain mindset to be dealing with the players. You knew at some point you're going to have to deal with the higher-ups. the management, but you're going to also have to deal with the players. Is that what motivated you the most? Was it the idea that you just wanted to be a part, get yourself in the door, basically? Or did you also want to deal with the part as far as having relationships with the players?
Well, I think it was a little bit of everything. I wanted to work in the league, and having no experience in the league at that point, it was really an opportunity to really do a little bit of everything, which, as I said, I was fortunate enough to do because our staffs were so small in those days. And I loved working with the players. I can remember, like, our first training camp with the Clippers. You know, we're coaching Bill Walton. You know, we're coaching Brian Taylor, Sidney Wicks. You know, guys that I've watched play collegiately as a fan, and now we're out on the floor, you know, coaching these guys. And what I found was encouraging was that I was curious how I would be received as a young guy coming in with no NBA experience other than being a regional scout and a part-time scout. I found that the players were extremely receptive if they believed you could help them be successful. Like if they believed you could help them be a better player, then they bought in 100% to what you were doing. And so it's a part of that is developing that relationship and being able to show them how you can improve this aspect of their game or this particular skill set. And we put a lot of time in the summer with players. And I think that's where we really built the relationship, was more in the summertime than during the regular season.
Wow. You came into contact with a lot of players. Yeah, guys such as Mookie Blaylock, over your career. A lot of players mm-hmm. that I've known, it saddens me today because you mentioned Bill Walton. You mentioned Sidney Wicks. It saddens me today because you got all these great players. And today you don't hear about them. It's like they've fallen under the radar. When you were coming up with those guys, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I agree with you. It's sad that not more is known about them today by today's generation. And I put stuff every year on Facebook. I do a whole thing during Black History Month where every day I do a post trying to help people understand the history of the game, the history of the league, and the pioneers really that started everything. For example, If you ask players and coaches and general managers today, can you tell me who the first African American player was in the NBA? Very few can tell you. Everybody right. knows Jackie Robinson, but hardly anybody knows who the first NBA player was. And part of it is lack of education about it, and part of it is it's a little more complicated than it was in baseball. And that's because it's almost a three-part answer. Earl Lloyd was the first African-American to step floor in an NBA game. But the first player drafted was Chuck Cooper by the Boston Celtics. It was in 1950 was the year that the league integrated. So Chuck Cooper's drafted 11th or 12th that year by the Boston Celtics. Earl Lloyd's drafted like a 100th pick that year by the Washington Capitals. Sweetwater Clifton was the third player drafted by the Knicks, but the first drafted is Chuck Cooper. The first to play is Earl Lloyd, but the first to sign a contract was a little known player named Harold Hunter, a point guard. The Washington Capitals signed him as the first African American to sign a contract in that same year. And then they end up cutting Harold, probably, and I can't say this definitively because I wasn't around in the league in 1950, but I'm guessing from everything that I've read, probably because it was an unofficial quota system when they integrated the league, the owners were saying, okay, we'll each carry one African-American player, and Washington Capitals had drafted Earl Lloyd, and now they signed Harold Hunter, and then they got cold feet. Like in training camp and said, well, we can't carry two players, so they cut Harold. I don't know that's a fact. but there's an awful lot to support that. But my point is that
Pete,
nobody knows about the history of the league.
And Pete, I actually knew about Harold Hunter. Harold Hunter used to be the head basketball coach at Tennessee State in my hometown of Nashville, Tennessee. That's the only reason I knew it. But yeah, he was a really good coach there at TSU, and he was there along with the great John McClendon.
Exactly. Yeah, who if you study basketball, was really the father of the fast break. You know, people will give Red Auerbach credit for the fast break. They give others credit. John McClendon's the first coach that most people will acknowledge ever ran a fast break system. And a lot of white coaches used to come to his practices to study how he prepared his team and how he played, because his teams would just run over everybody.
So was that the original fast break? Where is that, like, not that was the fast break when you the goal was the point guard stops at the free throw line?
Yes, yeah, it was. John's fast break. Ben Jobe, who passed away a couple of years ago, was a good friend of mine and one of my mentors, and we used to talk about this hours and hours. And he was a student of John McClendon's, we used to talk about his Coach Mack's system, and then Coach Jobe used it himself when he coached collegiately. It was not like a paint by the numbers kind of fast break. It was basically get out and fill the lanes. It's the first two guys that can fill the lanes, you fill them, and the ball moves as quickly as you can down the floor. Pass it rather than dribble it if you can advance the ball, because the pass is faster than the dribble. And you take the best shot you can, first shot you can get that's a good shot. And it was hard to defend it.
Yes, sir.
Well, I asked that question for you and Ricky to break the ice a little bit, because I look at the evolution now, and a lot of these young kids today, they don't know anything about they don't know the terms like the trailer. In our era, it was you get out the wings, run the floor. The guys, a lot of them, you know, Elgin Baylor, guys like that, you run the floor. The big man runs to the block, and then you got your trailer. And I look at the game today, it's so different. It's kind of amazing, because when you play, even like when you started serving the Nuggets, in 1984, were the Nuggets getting up and down the floor? Was that a time like basically when the NBA, we picked up the pace as far as getting up and down the floor?
Absolutely. The 6 years I was in Denver, Doug Moe was our coach the whole 6 years. And Doug was one of the more unorthodox coaches in basketball, but also one of the best, because he had a great feel for actually both ends of the floor. People knew us. We would lead the league in scoring oftentimes during the 6 years I was there. And in fact, we had great battles with San Antonio, some scoring battles with them. And in fact, with the 84-85 season, we played San Antonio opening round of the playoffs, and it was a dogfight with them. And we beat them, but it was a tough series. But Doug was a master at teaching the fast break. His whole offense, he simplified the game. Everybody today tries to complicate the game, but he simplified the game in that his offensive playbook was basically pass and cut and don't stand still. You know, it's like, and people would say that was it. You know, it's like we didn't have set plays. We didn't come down and, you know, players looking over at the bench, what should we run? It was pass and cut and don't stand still. If you held the ball longer than 2 seconds, Doug would lose his mind. You know, it's like when you caught the ball, you either had a shot or you had a drive to the basket. If you're not, you pass the ball and you cut to the basket hard yourself. And cutters, look at Alex English. Alex English scored more points in the NBA in the 1980s. For that decade, he scored more points than any player in the NBA. Now, Alex was not a three-point shooter. He was not a great one-on-one player, but he scored a ton of points. How did he do it? He did it because he was such an intelligent player, and he moved so well without the ball. And so if you look at Alex, he'd score 30 points a night off of cuts to the basket, 15-foot jumpers, the floaters, that he used to shoot, you know, off balance shots, but they were all going to the basket. In today's world, if you lead the NBA in scoring, you're a 3-point shooter. You know, it's a given. In those days, Alex didn't even take a 3-pointer.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Pete, that's why I'm such a big fan of that era of basketball. You know, I enjoy the NBA today, but I love that era of the game where you had to do more than just jack it up. Hey, I one other question before I get you back in here, Derek. I think you were about to say something. One thing, going back to Coach McClendon, and I was a little boy, and I don't remember, but I remember hearing people talk about the Tennessee State teams and with Dick Barnett at guard, and Pete, he would shoot it, and he knew it was going, and he'd say, and his thing was fallback baby. So when the kids around town play basketball, they shoot it all, fallback baby. And that was just the impact that, you know, those teams had on kids throughout the community.
He used to have that leg kick too. When he shot his jumper, both of his legs kicked up behind him. And I remember watching players actually imitate that, trying to do it, see if it would help their shot. But go ahead, I don't want to interrupt you.
No, but you're right. I mean, Dr. Dick Barnett, he's a friend of the show as well.
Yeah.
But with Doug Moe, it seems to me that he brought some of the ABA concepts to the NBA as a coach. He was a player in the ABA where George got his start and Dr. J and all those guys. Do you think that was part of his ability to make the offensive game run so smoothly?
I would guess so. I never asked Doug about that, but I would assume so, because he and Larry Brown, you know, were good friends and teammates in the ABA, and they both liked that open court type of play and simplifying the game. Doug was just a genius at making the game a simple game rather than a complicated game. You know, I told you offensively what basically his playbook was. Defensively, his playbook was, and people didn't think we played defense. We played really good defense. His defensive playbook was basically pick up the ball at half court, pressure the ball like crazy, deny everything one pass away. If you see somebody needs help, help them out. We didn't have rotations and weak side rotations and all these things. It was real simple. It wasn't complicated. Now, we also had a 3-guard rotation of Fat Lever, T.R. Dunn, and Elson Turner. Those three guys could defend like crazy. And so we would lead the league or be at the top of the league and force turnovers and steals, you know, the 6 years we were all together, because those guys were just locked down defenders.
You guys made it to the Western Conference Finals with that squad. Did you think that you guys that year, 85, that you guys had a chance to win it all? Because it seemed like the chemistry with the team was good. Do you think that was a really good year to think that you guys could actually go all the way?
Well, I mean, In reality, you know, we went up against the Lakers, the Showtime Lakers, with Kareem and Magic and Worthy and Byron and that whole group, Michael Cooper. So, I mean, we were by far the underdogs in the Western Conference Finals, but we did have phenomenal team chemistry, and we had guys that believed in one another and played together. We go out to play the Lakers game one in the Forum, and they blow us out, and the media basically wrote us off after the first game, if they had written us off already before the series started. Game two, we came back, and we beat them by 20 in the Forum and kind of shocked them. And then we go home, and we played, I think it was a double overtime game. Alex English broke his hand or his wrist in the game, and when Alex went out, it was pretty tough for us to stay on an even keel with them. But we were giving them pretty much all they could handle. But now, you know, do I look back on it and say we could have won the whole thing then? I probably not, just because, you know, Kareem, Magic, Worthy, that whole combination that they had in L.A. was phenomenal. We were overachievers, and that's because of Doug's system and because of the chemistry we had on the team.
You got Ricky. You familiar with that team at that time? Because you know that was that's when George was winding down his career with the Spurs, and it's funny to me that Mr. Babcock. It seemed like the Lakers stopped a few teams. You know, we had the same problem. That's the year George. Mm-hmm. You know, they had Otis Gilmore and Mike Mitchell, and we just could not get by the Lakers. And it's sometimes people talk about these teams, the all-time great teams. And I think sometimes that Lakers team is forgotten. But, you know, there were some other great teams like your Denver Nuggets, the Spurs. Those teams kind of fell under the radar. And it saddens me today because a lot of the young people, they don't study their history. Mr. Babcock, I had to bring up a name when you were talking about that Nuggets team. Is that a team also? Was Kiki Vandeweghe on that team as well?
No, we actually traded Kiki that prior to that season during the summer. To Portland for Fat Lever, Calvin Natt, Wayne Cooper, first and a second round pick, I think was what the deal was. And that's what made that team. We're not being disrespectful to Kiki, but it's just Kiki was so good. That's how much we got in return for Kiki. And that really started the 6 year run that we had with the Nuggets at that time, because Coop ended up being, you know, and Dan Issel was our starting center when we got Coop, but that was Dan's last year. Coop ended up being our starting center, was a defensive force, you know, shot blocker, plus he could make the jumper from 16, 17 feet, so he'd draw his man out. Fat Lever is probably the most underrated player of the 1980s, in my opinion, my biased opinion, because he was phenomenal. And Calvin Natt was just a warrior. I mean, Calvin Natt was an undersized power player who could do a little bit of everything and didn't back down from anybody. So I think Kiki was not part of it, but because of Kiki and his value, we were able to put that team together.
Hey,
none
Pete,
of those guys.
You,
go ahead, Ricky. Go ahead, Ricky.
No, I'm sorry, Derek. Go ahead.
I was going to just ask about, because I look at the styles today as opposed to that team. Your team got up and down the floor, but you didn't have any, all the guys you named, none of them were shooters. Calvin Natt was a very strong guy going to the basket, 15 feet and in guy. T.R. Dunn, all those guys, they were great defenders, but they weren't very good offensive players. How did you guys score so many points? I mean, was it just that all the guys bought in to sharing the ball? I never could figure that out, even back then. Was it just that the guys were that bought in and they sacrificed for the betterment of the team?
I think that was part of it. Everybody did sacrifice for the betterment of the team. We scored an awful lot off of forced turnovers. So, like I said before, with Fat, TR, and Elson defending the perimeter as effectively as they did, we forced a lot of steals. We get breakaways. None of those guys were known as being great pure shooters. I mean, Issel was probably our best shooter, and he was our center in terms of pure shooters. But those guys could score. I mean, they were smart, intelligent basketball players. So they all played to their strengths. If you look at Fat Lever's numbers, if you look at his best years, like I don't know what the best year was, like 86, 87, I'm not sure, you have to look it up, but he had some phenomenal lines. Here's a point guard, a 6'3 point guard who scored, let's say, 19.5 points a game, had 10 rebounds a game. He's a point guard. Assists were like, I don't know, 7 a game. Steals, like 2.5 steals a game. His numbers were just off the charts. But Fat wasn't a great pure shooter, but he was smart. He knew how to play. He picked his spots, and so you put all those guys together. We're pretty much the same in terms of our basketball IQ. It was a fun group to be around. Really enjoyed it. And you mentioned we played against George at the end of his career, when he was winding down. From my perspective, playing against San Antonio, I don't think he ever wound down. I mean, he was a handful all the time. I mean, it was like, how do you stop George, you know?
That's a good one, Pete. Hey, you're listening to Derek Gervin's As Good As It Gets Basketball podcast. and we have longtime NBA executive Pete Babcock as our guest this afternoon. And Pete is sharing some wonderful stories about his storied career in the National Basketball Association. And Pete, we still got a bunch of questions for you, and we could keep you just a few more minutes. And one of the things I want to ask you, as a personnel guy looking at guys, a guy I covered, I was a longtime sports writer. When I was in Nashville, I covered Anthony Mason at Tennessee State. And across town was Will Perdue, who was dominating the SEC. I mean, he's a good ball player. But, you know, I was telling everybody, the best basketball player in town is this skinny guy over here at Tennessee State, Anthony Mason, who wasn't nearly as big as he would go on to be. And Anthony ended up being a third-round pick, and I think Will went to the Bulls, first-round pick, played with Michael and won some championships. But I think Anthony had a longer, more of an impactful career as a player. How do guys like that, and like a Ben Wallace, how do guys like that go under the radar and then go on to do the things that they accomplish in the NBA?
Well, first of all, we should have had you on our scouting staff. That would have helped us a lot. I wish I would have talked to you at that time.
He was only about 200 pounds at Tennessee State.
No, I know.
And he was a point guard. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of reasons guys go under the radar. In times of change where there's so much social media today, and so much is on the airwaves, there aren't as many guys that fly under the radar. But it used to be, it happened, and it could be lack of exposure, where a guy's playing in a conference that just isn't as well scouted as it should be. Projected guys' growth pattern, and like from a player's perspective, like, you know, what's this guy's ceiling based on where he is today? I mean, I think the majority of it, guys that were under the radar, were simply lack of exposure for the most part. Some of those guys who had lack of exposure, like a guy like Scottie Pippen, get invited to the Portsmouth Invitational, and all of a sudden just blew up. You know, it's like, wow, you know, how Dennis Rodman, the same thing. You know, people they'd heard the name, they saw the numbers, but they go out like, yeah, he's playing at a small school or, you know, whatever. And maybe don't give it as much credence as they should. But then when they get the exposure, like playing one of the tournaments of the postseason, and they play really well, it gets your attention. And it happened with Pippen, it happened with Rodman. There are a number of guys you can talk about that, and as time goes on, I think more and more people started paying attention to the smaller conferences or the less recognized conferences, and not just the ACC and the SEC and so forth.
Mr. Babcock, you've been involved in this game in the Anthony Mason time and on. You dealt with the pre-draft camp for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in that? Because that became something that was really big in my era as I was coming up. We had the pre-draft camp in Chicago. How did you become a part of that?
Well, what happened was that camp started was the brainchild of several people: Pete Newell, Stu Inman, Jerry Colangelo, and possibly Wayne Embry. I think maybe Wayne was involved too. I'm not sure about that. But the other three I know for sure. And they talked the league into holding this camp. And at that time, I was an assistant coach with the Clippers. Jerry Colangelo called me and asked me if I was interested in coaching in the pre-draft camp. And of course I was, cause I was an aspiring young coach. And so I started coaching the first year at it. And then about 2 years later, Jerry called me and said, listen, Pete Newell and Stu Inman and I are, we got this thing up and running now. We want to turn it over to younger guys to run the camp. Are you interested in taking it over? And I said, absolutely, I'd love to do it. And so That's how it happened. They asked me to, and I we took it and ran with it, and ran the camp for, I don't know, until they changed the format. So it was in, up until I can't remember the exact year, 2004, 2005. At some point where they stopped the format of having actually competition and team play. I was involved with it for those years.
Wow.
Go ahead, Rick.
Derek?
No, I was just listening. I was amazed at this pre-draft stuff. I just wanted to know how it worked. Now, that was great.
Pete, this is more of your scouting and personnel decisions. As you were in the game a long time, did you begin to scout differently for players as the game changed from, you know, a big man's game to the game we have today? Do you look at players differently?
I don't know that you look at them that – at least I can only speak for myself. I can't speak to everybody else. I don't know that I ever looked at them that differently because, you know, I was taught the business by Bill Burtka, who is like one of the godfathers of scouting. And he used to run a service called Burtka Views, a collegiate scouting service, years and years ago. I was really taught to, you know, look at a player's physical attributes, speed, strength, flexibility, reaction time. Does the player have the physical attributes to compete in the NBA? And then you look at the mental aspects of it, you know, his – how he approaches the game. So you go to the game really early, you watch the player warm up, how serious he is in his preparation. Now this is before you've ever spoken to the player. So you just, this is all observation. You watch him on the bench, you watch him, how he interacts with his teammates, with his coaches, how he interacts with referees, all of that. And then you look for skill set and you go like, okay, you know, you, like a checklist of, you know, all the basics from shooting the basketball to handling the ball to rebounding to his defensive ability. And you're saying, okay, what does he bring to our team? Does this guy shoot the ball so well, he brings that to us? Does he rebound it so well? Is he a shot blocker? I mean, he's got to do something well enough that transfers to the NBA. Now, if he's a really, really good player, the great players are easy to see. Okay, there's no secret. You go watch the players who are the big time players. They jump right out at you and they do everything. So those are the easy ones. The hard ones were the ones where you're trying to find, is there something this guy can do that can contribute to us? And he can come off the bench and he can block shots. He can protect the lane for us for 5 or 6 minutes at a time. And then you're piecing it together when you come to draft time, what fits your team best and for that particular year and what fits your coaching staff and what they're looking for. So for me, it didn't change, even though the game has changed to where you don't have many low post players anymore. You don't have post up centers, stereotypically anyway. But that doesn't mean you don't evaluate the players the same way. If you went to a college game today and you watched the next Shaquille O'Neal or the next Bill Walton or, you know, there was a guy like that that played at that level, the collegiate level, you wouldn't turn your back on him and say, well, the NBA doesn't play that way anymore. You would say,
yeah,
bring this guy in and we'll change the way we play because now we got a low post presence. So I didn't view players differently, but you picking them for your team might be a little bit different.
That's good
with
stuff.
You, hey, Ricky, I got to get this part out because, you know, as Ricky knows, I just did a camp this past weekend at my family's gym at Gervin here in San Antonio. And my camp was 8 to 14-year-olds. And I just heard you talking, Mr. Babcock, about the intangibles that you look for. And one of the last things that you mentioned was a skill set. And, you know, that was very important to me, and I was happy to hear you say that because all I spent time talking about this past Saturday was the behavior. And a lot of times, you know, I look at some of these parents at these games, we get away from the behavior. And, you know, these kids are told that they're elite players, and, you know, that comes with a lot of expectations. So now you're telling them how great a player they are, but if that doesn't pan out, then the guys, they really have nothing, you don't have anything to fall back on. When you were picking your teams with the Nuggets and the Hawks and all of that, was that a big factor, was the behavior, since you had to incorporate all these different personalities?
I would say that character and behavior and I would say interest outside of basketball were always things that got my attention. And when we wavered from that and would pick – select a player or acquire a player that went against those norms, it was almost always a failure. You know, it just didn't work out. Not that the player wasn't a good enough player, but it's just, it didn't work out. The player wasn't good for team chemistry. It wasn't good for, you know, camaraderie of the team. And it just, it ended up being a failure. As long as we stayed with the formula, then it usually worked out successfully, as long as the player was a good enough player. Now, you know, there are times, you know, where you draft players who fit all the criteria you want. They're great people. They represent the best of everything, and you know, they're not quite good enough to play. And that's the fine line you're trying to draw. So you're trying to get a combination of both. And I always lean towards players who had interest in things that, you know, they loved basketball. That was a great passion, but they were interested in life. They were interested in things that were going on in the world. You know, you could have a conversation with them about what was happening in the world situation at the time and current events. And, you know, it's just like they showed an interest in what was going on in life. Cause I just felt those people had a better outlook about just not only basketball, but their career.
There's a
hey,
guy
Pete,
that you mentioned that. Right? I'm going, Ricky, let me say this really quick, because while he's on the subject, there's a guy that just retired here in San Antonio that fits everything you just said to a mold. Manu Ginobili, you know, he's become revered here in San Antonio, and a lot of people think it's just because of him being Latin or whatever. But this guy just, you know, he's worldly. He wanted to know what makes this light come on, what makes everything tick. And to me, that's the kind of people I like dealing with. I think that's important because at some point the basketball can get kind of tiring. And as you know, I told Ricky this before, it gets to the point where sometimes you didn't even know what city you were in. So you had to have something else to do. And I think I look at Golden State today. The guys, they spend a lot of time together. Do you really think that's important? Do you have to love your teammates? Let me say it that way. Do you have to pretty much love your teammates to be successful?
I think you have to respect your teammates to be successful. And it's a matter of semantics, I think. Loving your teammates, I think, is important too. But you really have to have respect. You can have – you know, the great thing about the league is that the most successful teams I've ever been involved with, we had great diversity on our team. We had players with different religious backgrounds. We had players who were from cities. We had players who were from rural areas. We had players from different parts of the world. They were all different. What we would do as a team, I had a program I called Life Experiences Program, and two times a month, I would schedule events for our players. They were mandatory events for us to be involved with, the entire team. For example, we'd fly into Washington, D.C. to play the Wizards, and we'd get there the night before, and I would call Ford's Theater, where Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, and I would say, you know, could you stay open for us and give us a private tour and tell us the story about everything that went on behind the scenes of the Lincoln assassination. And we'll stop there on the way to the hotel from the airport. And I never had anybody say no to us. Everybody was always very accommodating. I remember we walked into Ford's Theater, and our players all knew we were going to do this stuff twice a month. So we walk into Ford's player, and I think it was Sharif Abdul-Rahim said to me, he didn't quite see the relevancy of this particular one, because we did all these off the wall kinds of things. So I said, Reeve, just humor me. We're going to be here for an hour, and I'd like to get your input afterwards. What you think about it? So we go in, we sit down in Ford's Theater. They have a park ranger who's like an expert and a great speaker on the Lincoln assassination, and he talks to the team for like 45 minutes about conspiracy, not just John Wilkes Booth, but his co-conspirators, how they tried to kill a number of members of the government that same night. He tells them all the stories and how all the stuff happened. Well, Reef ended up asking so many questions. We were there for like almost 2 hours. And so as we're leaving, I said to him, I'm assuming you thought this was worthwhile. And he goes, oh man, this was great. He said, I knew Lincoln got assassinated, but I didn't know the whole story, but everything behind it. He said, this was amazing. Well, so my point is every city has something special in it to offer. And so everywhere we would go, we would try to find experiences that we could give our players that were outside of basketball. You know, we go to Memphis, we go to the Civil Rights Museum, and we go to the Lorraine Motel, you know, where Dr. King was assassinated. And so we want our players exposed to this. You know, we go to L.A., and when Coach Wooden was still alive, I would call him and say, would you have lunch with our team and address our team about anything you think is relevant? And he'd always say yes and come and talk to the guys, and we'd get his latest book for all the players. And we'd have John Lewis speak to the team about his experiences that working with Dr. King, and got John's book for all the players, and, you know, just give them as many experiences in life as possible, and, you know, hopefully help them grow as human beings.
That is fabulous stuff, man. And you know what, Pete, I'm a sports writer 33 years. I covered a lot of teams, college, professional, here in Detroit, covered the Lions and Pistons, and I covered the championship Pistons, 2004 Pistons, with Chauncey and Rip and those guys. And that was of all the teams I covered on the professional level, that's probably one of the closest teams I've seen. They did everything together. They went to dinner together. I mean, they really enjoyed each other's company. And there's no doubt in my mind that helped them get through some things that went on that year. That was the year with the big fight with Indiana. You know, they had a tough series with the Nets. But, man, they really enjoyed each other's company. And I just think that, nope, you know, I think that made a difference in them winning that championship. I can't tell you how, you know, in terms of statistics and everything.
Sure.
But Derek and Pete, they knew each other's every move out there, not only on the offensive end, but especially on the defensive end. And I just think all of that just came from, you know, well, some of that came from just their closeness.
Well, that I think that I agree with you 100%. And those are the intangibles you can't measure with analytics. You can't put numbers on it. You know, like somebody would say to me, you know, maybe sarcastically kidding around about one of the visits we would do and, you know, one of our life experience programs, like, well, how many wins do you think that's worth? You know, it's like you're missing the point. First of all, that's not the reason we're doing it. But you can't measure it. You know, you can't put a measurement on it. But in my mind, I would agree with you completely. I'm sure that it had a lot to do with Detroit winning the championship that year. They had talent. They had good team. But when you get guys locked in together like that to trust one another and they respect one another, then, you know, you can have differences politically. You can have differences religiously. You can have all kinds of other differences. But if you have that respect factor and you enjoy one another, that you just increase your opportunities for being successful.
Yeah. Yeah, and I agree with that. And one more quick thing before you, and I'm sure Derek has a couple of questions. You look at a guy like Chauncey Billups, who bounced around, number 5 overall pick in Boston, didn't work out there, Denver didn't work out there, Orlando, Minnesota. He was all over the place. And he comes to Detroit. Now, I had to give Coach Brown a lot of credit for that, too, because Coach Brown really, and it wasn't always easy between those two, but he really played. Somehow Coach Brown got through to him. Is that part of it, just being in the right place and with the right guy to see a guy blossom?
I think part of it is that. Part of it is, right place at right time with the right people. Another part of it is also just a player's development and understanding the league. You look at Danny Green, for example. We drafted him out of North Carolina when I was working with Cleveland. And he played for us 1 year and did a nice job. But then the Cavs let him go and he went to San Antonio. And San Antonio had him, cut him, played in their D League, brought him back, maybe cut him twice, I can't remember. But finally it clicked with him, you know. And so how much of it is the people he's with and how much of it is his just development as a player is probably a little bit of both.
Well, it's really Coach, some fascinating stuff, man.
Coach, I can't let you get off of this phone without bringing up. I have to bring up, first of all, I know some people are not familiar that you scouted the Cavs, I believe, from 2007 to 2016. And
yes,
you were a part of that championship team. How was it? Because I have to ask, Ricky knows we have a lot of conversations about the King James. What was it like being around LeBron James and seeing the way his game evolved as he got a little older?
Well, I have great respect for LeBron. First of all, because of what he does for other people, and particularly young people. And I told him a number of times, you know, everybody always talks about, you know, what a great player you are, you know, arguably the best player in the world, all this stuff. I said, that's all nice, but the fact that you have the mentality you have to give back and to do so much for other people, I said, speaks volumes to me to what kind of person you are. And that, to me, that's more important than all the MVPs you could ever win, you know, championships you could win. Now, in terms of winning, I was with LeBron before he went to Miami, and I was with him when he came back from Miami. And without question, we would never have won a championship had he not come back. And players fed off of him. His personality overrides everything that's there. I mean, he's phenomenal. Now, you know, in the finals, I thought Kyrie should have been the co-MVP of the finals because Kyrie was fantastic and as equally responsible for us winning as LeBron was. But it was a great experience being with him, without question.
So you won a championship with Cleveland, and then you also had another very special experience, 1996. What was it like being a part of the Olympic team?
That was a lot of fun also because I was on the committee, the men's committee, selected the team and selected the coaching staff. It was an honor to be asked to be part of it, and you know, that was Lenny was the head coach of the team, and Lenny and I were together in Atlanta at the time. We spent 7 years together in Atlanta, and tremendous 7 years, and you know, a great learning experience for me just being with Lenny. But yeah, the Olympic experience is hard to beat. You know, it's just incredible because all the players are playing for their country. They're, you know, they kind of put egos aside and, you know, let's just go out and win this thing. And it was a great group of people.
Hey,
from
Pete,
that
we
team
just got
that
a
you,
few.
Okay.
Oh, go
ahead, Ricky.
There.
Sorry. No, I want you to tell talk to the fans. I'll go ahead and take over here for the listeners. I wanted to tell everyone thanks for tuning in. We got a few more minutes here with Mr. Pete Babcock. I'm with my partner today, Ricky Hampton. Ricky also does the show, The African American Athlete. You can go to his website, AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. That show is every Tuesday. And also listening to my show today is called Derek Gervin's As Good As Gets Athlete. We do this periodically. No certain dates I do it on. I just do it when I'm feeling good and things are going on in the NBA world. Today has been a great day. We have Mr. Pete Babcock on here. We've been talking about the NBA for the last 40 years. We're going to get ready to close it out, but I had one more question, and then I hope Ricky has a question. Mr. Babcock, you look at the game from when you started, and then you look at it today. What do you think? Is it a good thing, the evolution of the game today? Because I'm still trying to get adjusted myself. It's become a three-point game, three-pointers, and basically layups. What do you think about the way the game has changed? Do you like the evolution of the game, how it's going today?
You know, there are parts of the game that I'm enamored with, and I like the way things have progressed. There are parts of it that maybe as old school guy and you could call it being a purist. I don't know if that's the right term, if that's really a fair term, but who is not as enamored with it. I've never been a huge fan of the 3-point line. But I understand the fans' excitement with three-pointers and the excitement it brings to the game. So I acknowledge that. When I was in Denver, we acquired Michael Adams in 1987 because he was a three-point specialist. We had great speed and quickness. We added him to our backcourt. He was the one guy we had on our team that was like a knockdown three-point shooter. I've just never been a huge fan of the three-pointer for a number of reasons. So one is I think that players start to rely on the three-pointer. I see players step back to take a shot rather than stepping into a shot, so which is you're out of your rhythm and you're fading away from the basket when you step back to play the line. It used to be before we had the three-point line, when somebody caught the ball in the corner, they never stepped out of bounds. Today, people step out of bounds all the time because they're playing the three-point line. They're not playing the court line, the out-of-bounds line. They're playing the three-point line. They lose sight of where their feet are, where their heels are. And it gets every game, you see, once or twice every game, somebody catches the ball and their foot's out of bounds. It never used to happen. So that bothers me a little bit. I know the analytic people, and I'm not anti-analytics. I like analytics. As a piece of the puzzle, but I don't think it's the answer to everything. But I think it's a valuable piece of research to study and help you make decisions. But, you know, the analytics will say that it's better to take a three-pointer than a two-pointer, even though percentages are lower in making them. You still get 3 points rather than two. I understand the numbers, but it just it's taken away from that mid-range game. It's taken away from the low post game. And it's just the variety that used to exist in the league. You know, nobody posts up anymore. You don't see people take hook shots and, you know, low post moves aren't something that people are working on a regular basis. That's just me, you know, and I understand the excitement of it, but I've never been a huge fan of it.
Yeah, I'm sure with you, Pete. And, you know, last night I'm watching the Pistons game, and after the game, Coach Dwayne Casey, who I think is a heck of a coach, he was talking about it. The Pistons shot the ball poorly in the first half, and Coach said, I went in there and told him at halftime, hey, keep letting it fly. You got to start making these threes. And that was their thing, to come out and shoot three-pointers, despite the fact you have Andre Drummond and Blake Griffin on the floor. Of course, Blake hit 5 3-pointers last night himself. So, but that's the game we had today. But, Pete, man, We got to have you back. It's just so many more questions and observations we'd love to discuss with you, and we really appreciate you coming on the show.
No, I'm happy to do it. Guys, I'm retired, so you can call me anytime.
Hey, sir, and
I'm always available.
And I will be calling you again because we have a few more. I hope you really will come back on the show again. I think it's been fantastic.
Absolutely.
And no, thank you very much. Go ahead.
I enjoy speaking with you guys, and I'm serious. Anytime you need me back and you want to talk about the history of the game or, I love all that. So talk as much as you want about it.
And Pete, that's one thing
pleasure.
We do on Derek Gervin's, on Derek's podcast and on the African American Athlete. We talk about a lot of the players from back in the day, a lot of the history of the game, not only in basketball, but in other sports. And we talk about, the impact that these players, a guy like LeBron, has off the court, too. So some of the things you talked about tonight are exactly what we try to do with our shows.
Good. That's great. I love that. So I would love to come anytime you want to talk about it, just give me a call and we'll talk.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. You have a great evening.
Okay. Good to talk to you guys.
Take care. Yes, sir.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Mr. Ricky.
Oh, Derek, that was fantastic.
Fantastic. That gentleman there, that's NBA personified. And I'm
yes,
hoping
sir.
The listeners heard him. We really want to have him back at some point. I thought it was a great show.
Absolutely. And hey, man, I'm wishing you and your family a wonderful Christmas holiday.
Same to you, Ricky. Same to you and your family and all the listeners out there, to you and your families as well. We hope everybody has a successful holiday and a very safe holiday.
All right, brother.
All right,
sir. We out of here.
Well, you take care of yourself. Have a great evening.
All right. You've been listening to
right,
Derek Gervin's As Good As It Gets Basketball podcast.
Good night.
Good night.